There's nothing so hard in police work as having to inform a relative about a death in the course of an investigation. There's no way to get used to the pain that fills their eyes, the way all the color drains from their faces. Any attempt to be sociable, to laugh and joke, vanishes. The last thing to go is an effort to appear rational, to try to ask sensible questions. Irina gathers together some crumbs on the table with a trembling hand. Hope and fear flit across her face. "I'm afraid we've got bad news," Yuna says. "Your sister Natalia is dead. Her remains have just been found." "Now?" she asks hollowly. "She's been dead for 9 years. I don't understand. But she's only just been found. In Sweden? I looked for her. I don't understand." "She had been buried, but couldn't be identified before. That's why it's taken so long." The small hands keep moving the crumbs, then slip onto her lap. "How did it happen?" she asks, her eyes still wide open and empty. "We're not sure yet," Eric replies.
"Her heart was always... She didn't want to worry us, but sometimes it would just stop beating. It felt like an eternity before it..."
Irina's chin begins to tremble. She hides her mouth with her hand, looks down and swallows hard.
"Have you got anyone to talk to after work?" Nelly asks.
"What?"
She quickly wipes the tears from her cheeks, swallows again, and looks up.
"Okay," she says in a more focused voice. "What do I have to do? Do I have to pay anything?"
"Nothing. We'd just like to ask a few questions," Yuna says. "Would that be okay?" She nods and starts picking at the crumbs on the table again. They hear a metallic sound from the kitchen and someone tries the door.
"Did you have any contact with your sister while she was in Sweden?"
Irina shakes her head. Her mouth moves slightly, then she looks up.
"I was the only person who knew she was heading to Stockholm, but I promised not to say anything. I was young. I didn't understand. She was very stern with me, said she wanted to surprise Mum with her first wages. Nothing ever came. But I spoke to her on the telephone once. She just said that everything would be all right."
Irina falls silent and drifts off.
"Did she say where she was living?" "We haven't got any brothers," she replies. "Dad died when we were little. I don't remember him, but Natalia did. And after Natalia had gone, there was just me and Mum left. Mum missed her so much. She used to cry and worry about her weak heart, and said she just knew that something terrible had happened. So I thought if I could find my sister and take her back home, then everything would be fine. Mum didn't want me to leave, and she was alone when she died."
"I'm so sorry," Yuna says.
"Thank you. Well... Now I know that Natalia is dead,"
Irina says, getting to her feet.
"I suppose I suspected as much, but now I know."
"Do you know where she was living?"
"No."
She takes a step towards the door, clearly keen to get away from the whole situation. "Please sit down for a moment," Eric asks.
"Okay, but I need to get back to work."
"Irina," Yuna says, with a dark resonance in his voice that makes the young woman listen,
"your sister was murdered." "No, I just told you, her heart..."
Irina's coat catches on the back of the chair, dragging it backwards with her. As the truth sinks in, she loses control of her face. Her cheeks turn white, her lips quiver, and her pupils dilate.
"No,"
she whimpers. She leans back against the worktop,
shakes her head, fumbles across the front of the fridge for something to hold on to. Nelly tries to calm her down, but she pulls free.
Irina, you need to go. No, not Natalia, she cries. She promised.
She grabs hold of the handle of the fridge, and the door swings open as she falls, dislodging a shelf full of ketchup and jam. Nelly hurries across to her and holds her slender shoulders.
Niemaya kiastra, she gasps. Niemaya kiastra.
She curls up in Nelly's lap and tries to hold her hand over her mouth as she cries, screaming into her palm and shaking uncontrollably. After a while, she calms down and sits up, but she's still breathing unevenly between sobs. She wipes her tears and clears her throat weakly, trying to control her breathing.
Did someone hurt her?
She asks in a ragged voice.
Did they hit her? Did they hit Natalia?
Her face contorts again as she tries to hold her tears back, but they run down her cheeks. Yuna takes some napkins from a pack on the worktop and hands them to her, then pulls a chair over and sits down in front of her.
If you know anything at all, it's very important that you tell us,
he says sternly.
What could I know?
She says, looking at them in confusion.
We are just trying to find the person who did this, Nelly says, brushing the hair from Irina's face.
You spoke to your sister on the phone, Yuna goes on. Did she tell you where she lived or what her job was? There are those men who trick girls from poor countries, who say they're going to get good jobs. But Natalia was smart. She said it wasn't anything like that, that it was real. She promised me, but I've been to the furniture factory. No one there had heard of Natalia. Durnaya Jautinka. They're not employing anymore. Haven't done for years.
Her eyes are red from crying, and tiny red spots have appeared on the fair skin of her forehead.
What's the name of the factory? Eric asks.
Sofa Zone, she says blankly. It's out in Högdalen.
Nelly remains seated on the floor with Irina, stroking her head and promising to stay with her for as long as she wants. Eric exchanges a quick glance with Nelly, then walks back out through the noisy kitchen with Yuna. Chapter 80. Margot Silverman is sitting in front of a computer in the investigation room, looking at Eric's recording of Rocky's hypnosis again. His large head is drooping forward as he describes his visit to the zone in a languid voice. He talks about the dealers and strippers and the fact that he thought he could pick up some money there. As Margot listens, her eyes drift along the walls of the room. The victim's patterns of movement are marked in three different colors on the large map. Every place, every street where they could have come into contact with the preacher is marked. On the screen, Rocky shakes his head as he says that the preacher smells of fish guts. Margot sees the pin in the map marking Rebecca Hanson's home in Salem. Serial killers usually stick to their home patch, but in this case, the locations are spread out across the most densely populated metropolitan district in Scandinavia.
The preacher snorts back some snot, then starts to speak in a really high voice, Rocky says, breathing unevenly.
Margot shudders and watches the big man squirm on his chair and howl with angst as he describes the way the preacher cuts the woman's arm off.
It sounds like when you stick a spade into mud.
After the discovery out in Skogkyrkogården, no one doubts that the preacher is the serial killer that they're all looking for.
She knows it was Una who persuaded Niels Orlean to order the body to be exhumed. It would have been much easier if she could work with Una openly. But Benny Rubin and Peter Neslund are backing up Adam, resisting his involvement. Margot doesn't have the authority to let Una join the investigation, but she's sure as hell not going to stop him from conducting his own inquiries.
Rocky shakes his head, and his shadow moves across the glossy Playboy pinup on the wall behind him.
"The preacher chops her arm off at the shoulder," Rocky gasps, "loosens the tourniquet, and drinks."
"Listen to my voice now," Eric says.
"And drinks the blood from her arm, while Tina lies bleeding to death on the floor. Dear God in heaven, dear God."
Inside Margot's womb, the baby moves so violently that she has to lean back and close her eyes for a while. The preliminary investigation is proceeding systematically according to established routines, but no one really believes that's going to produce results in time. The police have knocked on doors and questioned many hundreds of neighbors. They've examined all the footage from surveillance and traffic cameras around the crime scenes. Unless Rocky returns to Karsuden Hospital soon so that Eric can question him properly, they'll have to make a public appeal for information about him. Margot switches the video off and has a strong feeling that she's being watched, so gets up and closes the curtains over the window looking out onto the park. She opens her bag and takes out her powder compact, looks at herself in the little mirror, and puts some more powder on. Her nose has got shiny, and the rings under her eyes look darker. She reapplies her lipstick, blots her lips on a letter from the National Police Board, adjusts her hair, then calls Jenny on Skype. She can see herself on the screen, and as the call is connected, she undoes one button on her blouse and moves backwards slightly so that her cheeks are framed better. Jenny answers almost immediately. She looks cross but attractive, with her messy black hair tumbling over her thin shoulders. She's wearing a washed-out vest, and the little golden heart is shimmering against her neck.
"Hi, baby," Margot says quietly. "Have you caught the bad guy yet, then?" "I thought I was the bad guy," Margot says.
Jenny smiles and stifles a yawn.
"Did you call the bank about that ridiculous charge?"
"Yes, and apparently there's nothing wrong with it," Jenny replies.
"That can't be right."
"So call them yourself."
"I just meant..." "Okay, never mind. It's so irritating when they deduct payments for..." "Oh, what the hell."
"What did you want?"
Jenny asks, picking at her armpit.
"How are the girls?" Margot asks.
"Fine,"
Jenny says, glancing off to one side.
"But Linda's still a bit down. She needs to learn to make new friends. She's far too nice."
"Being nice is a good thing, surely," Margot points out.
"But she doesn't know what to do when her best friend says she's got fed up of her. She just gets upset and sits and waits."
"She'll learn."
Margot would like to be able to tell Jenny about the investigation, about the meaningless hatred, and her feeling that the preacher is close by, watching them all. She feels worried for herself because she keeps forgetting all the things that normal people know, and the fact that she's going to have a baby, and that people can be happy and secure.
"You look nice," Margot says, tilting her head to one side.
"No, I don't,"
Jenny grins, then yawns loudly.
"Right. I'm going to carry on watching a repeat of the Stockholm Horse Show."
"Okay. I'll call again later."
Jenny blows her a kiss and ends the call, leaving Margot looking at her own face. Her father's nose and those thick, colorless eyebrows.
"I look like someone's aunt," she thinks.
like my dad, if he'd been a woman. The suspicion that there's something wrong between her and Jenny is snaking its way through Margot's head when Adam Youssef comes into the room and opens the window facing the park. He's been in a meeting with Nathan Pollock and Elton Erickson from the National Murder Unit in an attempt to prune the list of potential perpetrators and help move the preliminary investigation forward.
"I had Pollock as one of my lecturers when I was training," Margot says.
"Yes, he said," Adam replies as he sits down and leafs through a bundle of papers.
"Have you got the new profile there?" Margot asks.
Adam runs his hands through his thick hair in frustration.
"They just keep repeating things we already know. That's how it works. Setting up things that seem obvious as the parameters," she replies, leaning back. "The murders are characterized by a high degree of risk-taking, forensic awareness, and excessive brutality," he reads. "The victims are women of childbearing age. The crime scenes are the victims' homes. The motive is instrumental, and the violence probably expressive."
Margot listens to the generalizations and thinks about the fact that Anya's list of names has grown even longer. Considering that Sweden is the most secular country in the world, she can't help thinking that there are an awful lot of priests and preachers. They've now got almost 500 people with direct connections to various faith organizations in the Stockholm area who match the general profile. This investigation has ground to a halt, she finds herself thinking once more. If only they had one sighting, just one decent piece of information to go on. They need to bring things into focus. There isn't enough time to check out more than 500 men. Given the murderer's momentum so far, the video of his next victim could appear at any time. In order to limit the search as things stand, we need to add in some uncertain parameters, she thinks. Previous violent crimes, for instance, or personality disorders.
There are 42 men who've been suspects in other cases. 9 have been convicted of violent crimes, 9 for stalking, 9 for murder, and 9 for brutality that bears any resemblance to our serial killers, Adam says. 11 have convictions for sexual offences, 30 for drugs.
Just give me someone to shoot, she says wearily.
I've got 3 names. None of them is a perfect match, but 2 of them have been investigated for crimes of violence against more than one woman.
Good.
The first one is a Sven Hugo Andersson, a vicar in the parish of Danderyd. The other one's a Pasi Jokala. He used to be active in the Philadelphia church, but now he's got his own congregation known as the Yertuna Revivalists. And the third one? I'm not sure, but he's the only one of these 500 who has a documented personality disorder that matches the profile. A 20-year-old diagnosis for borderline psychosis. But he's got no criminal record, doesn't feature in either police or social service registers. And he's also been married for 10 years, which doesn't fit the profile at all.
Better than nothing, she says.
Anyway, his name's Thomas Apel, and he's the so-called stake president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints out in Jakobsberge.
We'll start with the violent ones, she says, and stands up. Adam goes to his office to call his wife and tell her he's got to work late, and Margot stops in the kitchen, looks in the cupboard, and pops Pieter Neslund's packet of jam biscuits in her bag before she walks out. Adam's account of the perpetrator profile has made her think about stalker and serial killer Dennis Rader, whom she wrote an essay about when she was training. He used to call the police and media to tell them about his murders. He even used to send the police objects he'd taken from his victims. In his case, the perpetrator profile was completely wrong. They had been looking for a divorced, impotent loner, whereas Raider was married, had children, and was active in both the church and the scouting movement. Chapter 81. They go together in Margot's comfortable Lincoln. To make room for her stomach, she's had to move the seat so far back that she can barely reach the pedals with her feet. Only two of the three names are left. It turns out that Sven Hugo Andersson was in Donderried Hospital for a bypass operation when Sandra Lundgren was murdered. Once they're past Södertälje, they head along the 225 motorway through fields of yellow rape, past a large industrial area dominated by AstraZeneca's pale grey facility. They pass beneath some tall electricity pylons, then head into a forested area. Margot puts a biscuit in her mouth, chews, tasting the crumbly mixture of sugar and butter, then the chewy tart jam. "Are those Peter's biscuits?" Adam asks. "He gave them to me," she says, popping the next biscuit in her mouth. "He wouldn't even offer one to his wife. But he was very insistent that you have a couple," she says, passing him the packet. Adam takes a biscuit and eats it with a smile, holding one hand under his mouth so as not to drop crumbs in Margot's car. The road gets narrower, grit flies up behind them, and Margot has to slow down. They can make out the occasional cottage down by the lake. Pasi Jokala was convicted of aggravated assault, rape, and attempted rape. Margot hasn't been on operational duty since she got pregnant, but she's choosing to see this as an extension of office work, given that Pasi Jokala has no listed phone number. "Do you think he's dangerous?" Adam asks. The two of them know that they shouldn't have come out here without the National Task Force, if they really believe they've found the unclean preacher. But just to be on the safe side, Margot has brought her Glock and four extra magazines. "He has problems with aggression and a lack of impulse control," she says. "But who the hell hasn't?" Pasi Jokala is registered as living at the same address as the Yertuna Revivalist Church. Margot turns off onto a narrow gravel road through sparse forest and can see the lake again. Some 50 cars are parked along the side of the road, but she drives all the way to the fence before stopping. "We don't have to do this now," Adam says. "I'm just going to take a look," Margot says, checking her gun before putting it back in its holster and struggling out of the car. They're standing in front of a rust-red cottage with a white cross made of LED lights covering the gable end. The light inside looks like it's filtering out of the building through narrow gaps in the wood. Behind the house, a wild meadow stretches down towards the lake. The windows are covered on the inside. A loud voice can be heard through the walls. A man shouts something, and Margot feels a sudden pang of unease. She keeps walking, her holster rubbing against her. It's sitting too high now that her stomach has grown. They walk past a water butt, thistles a meter tall, and a rusty lawnmower. Dozens of slugs lurk in the shadowy grass beside the wall. "Maybe we should wait here until they've finished," Adam wonders. "I'm going in," Margot says curtly. They open the door and walk into the hall, but now everything is completely silent, as if everyone were waiting for them to arrive. On the wall is a poster about meetings beside the lake and a group trip to Alabama. On a table is a bundle of printouts about fundraising for the Yertuna Revivalists' new church, next to a buckled cash box and 20 copies of the Redemption hymnal. Adam is hesitant, but she waves him towards her. It may be a church, but she still wants him in the right position if there's going to be any gunfire. Margot holds her stomach with one hand as she walks through the next door. she can hear the sound of murmuring voices. The rest of the building is a single white church hall. The beams of the roof are held up by pillars, and everything is painted brilliant white. There are rows of white chairs on the white floor, and up at the front is a small stage. A couple of dozen people have stood up from their seats. Their eyes are fixed on the man on the stage. Margot realizes that the man in front of them is Pasi Jokala. He's wearing a blood-red shirt with open cuffs that are hanging down over his hands. His hair is sticking up from one side of his head, and his face is sweaty. His chair is lying on its side behind him. The members of the small choir are silent, looking at him with their mouths open. Pasi raises his head wearily and gazes out across the congregation.
I was the mud beneath his feet, the dust in his eye, the dirt under his nails, he says. I sinned, and I sinned on purpose. You know what I have done to myself and to others. You know what I said to my own parents, to my mother and father.
The congregation sighs and shuffles uncomfortably.
The sickness of sin was raging in me.
Pasi, a woman whimpers, looking at him with moist eyes. They all start to mutter prayers.
You know that I mugged a man and beat him with a rock, Pasi goes on with growing intensity. You know what I did to Emma, and when she forgave me. I left her and Miko. You know that I drank so much that I ended up in hospital.
The congregation is moving agitatedly now. Chairs scrape the floor, some topple over, and one man falls to his knees. The atmosphere grows more tense, and Pasi's voice is hoarse from chanting. The meeting seems to be reaching a crescendo. Margot retreats towards the door as she sees two women holding each other's hands and speaking a strange language, incomprehensible, repetitive words, faster and faster.
But I put my life in the Lord's hands and was baptized in the Holy Spirit, Pasi goes on. Now I am the drop of blood running down Christ's cheek. I am the drop of blood.
The congregation cheers and applauds. The little choir starts to sing with full force.
The chains of sin are broken. I am free. I am free. I am delivered of my sin. I am free. Saved and free. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Jesus died for me. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. I am free. I am free.
The congregation joins in, clapping along, and Pasi Jokala stands there with his eyes closed, sweat running down his face. Chapter 82. Margot and Adam wait outside the church and watch the congregation emerge. They're smiling and chatting, switching their phones on and reading messages as they head towards their cars, waving and saying their goodbyes. After a while, Pasi comes out alone. His red shirt is unbuttoned down his chest, and the fabric is dark with sweat under the arms. He's holding a plastic bag from Statoil in his hand as he carefully locks the door.
Pasi, Margot says, taking a few steps towards him.
The pallets are in the garage, but I need to get to the co-op before they shut, he says, heading towards the gates.
We're from the National Criminal Investigation Department, Adam says.
Would you please stop?
Margot says in a sharper tone of voice. He comes to a halt with one hand on the gatepost and turns towards Margot.
I thought you were here because of the advert. I've got 5 pallets of Polish Mr. Muscle that I usually sell to a discount store, but they've cut their order. Do you live here? There's a smaller cottage a little way away.
And a garage, Margot adds. He doesn't answer, just prods a rusty pipe that's been stuck into the ground. Can we take a look? Adam asks.
No, Pasi leers. We'll have to ask you to come with us.
I haven't seen any ID, he says, almost in a whisper.
Adam holds his badge up in front of Pasi, but he barely looks at it. He just nods to himself and pulls the pipe from the ground.
Drop that now, Margot says.
Holding the pipe with both hands, Pasi walks slowly towards her. Adam moves aside and draws his Sikh Sauer.
I have sinned, he says softly, but I...
Stop!
Adam shouts. Something lets go of Pasi's tense frame. He stops and tosses the pipe into the grass.
I have actively sought out sin, but I am forgiven, he says wearily.
By God, maybe, Margot replies, but I need to know where you've been for the past 2 weeks.
I've been in Alabama, he explains calmly. In the USA?
We were visiting a church in Troy. We were there 2 months. I got home the day before yesterday. There was a revivalist meeting on a wooden bridge with a roof,
Pasi smiles,
like the barrel of a cannon filled with prayer and song that in itself made the whole trip worthwhile.
Margot and Adam keep hold of Pasi while they confirm what he says with the passport authority. It all checks out, and they apologize for troubling him, get back in the car, and drive off through the dark forest.
So, did you see the light? Adam says after a while.
Almost.
I need to go home.
Okay, she says. I can talk to Thomas Appel on my own.
No,
Adam says. We know he isn't violent.
Thomas Appel is the stake president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints out in Jakobsberg. Of the 500 names on their list, he's the only one who has suffered from a borderline psychotic personality disorder.
Let's do that tomorrow, Adam pleads.
Okay, she lies.
He glances sideways at her.
It's just that Katrina doesn't like being at home on her own, he confesses.
Yes, you've been away a lot recently.
It's not that.
She drives slowly along the winding forest track. The baby in her stomach moves and stretches out.
I could have a word with Jenny, Margot says. I'm sure she could go and be with Katrina.
I don't think so, he says with a smile.
What?
She laughs.
No, stop it. Are you worried Katrina might lose her virginity?
Stop it, Adam says, squirming in his seat. Margot picks up a biscuit and waits for him to say whatever he's trying to say.
I know Kata, and she wouldn't want me to arrange for someone to keep her company. She just wants me to prove that I care about our relationship. I'll go home as soon as we've spoken to Thomas Appel.
Okay,
Margot says, and can't help feeling relieved that Jenny isn't going to have to spend the night with Katrina. Chapter 83. The private limited company, Sofa Zone, turns out to be based on Kviksundvegen in Högdalen Industrial Estate, close to the railway depot. Eric and Yuna are driving along next to a barbed wire fence towards 30 or so parked dustbin lorries. Grey drizzle is falling, sparkling like sand. The little monkey girl is swinging beneath the ignition key. In the distance, white smoke is billowing from a chimney on the far side of some tall electricity wires. They pass wide, empty roads between low industrial buildings bearing corporate flags and signs about private security companies, alarms, and camera surveillance. Barbed wire fences glint in front of car parks, full of articulated lorries, vans, and containers. The windscreen wipers sweep the rain aside mechanically, leaving a dirty triangle beyond the reach of the blades.
Pull over, Yuna says.
Eric drives round an old tire by the side of the road, slows down, and stops the car. On the other side of the road, weeds and dandelions are growing in front of a tall fence crowned with four rows of barbed wire. They stare at the big, corrugated metal building. Rust has trickled down from the screws holding up the large sign bearing the name Sofa Zone.
"This is the zone, isn't it?" Eric says seriously.
"Yes," Yuna says, and drifts off in thought. Rain covers the windscreen as soon as the wipers stop. The tiny drops quickly form little streams. The zone's only window is in the office at the front. It's grimy and covered with bars. In the parking spaces next to the fence stand 9 private cars and 2 motorbikes.
"What are we going to do?" Eric says after a while.
"If Rocky is here, we try to get him out," Yuna says. "And if he doesn't agree to that, you'll have to question him here. But it's not enough for him to say that the preacher takes drugs, wears makeup, and..."
I know.
"We need an address, a name," he concludes.
"So, how do we get inside?" Yuna opens the door, and cool air brings a smell of wet grass into the car. The noise of the huge railway yard can be heard over the sound of the worsening rain. They leave the car and cross the road. The rain is cooling the ground, and mist is rising from the tarmac.
"How does your hip feel?" Eric asks.
"Fine."
They go through the gates into the industrial estate. There's wet cardboard on the ground with disintegrating labels for 3-seat sofas and double divans. Through the filthy window, they can see that the office is dark. A car stops in the car park, and a man in a dark grey suit gets out and walks round the far end of the building. They wait a few moments, then follow him along the windowless facade. Yuna takes out his phone and films the car's registration number as he passes. On the end of the warehouse is a concrete loading bay with metal steps. Beside the large rolling door for goods is a smaller buckled steel door. They carry on to the end of the building, crossing the shimmering black tarmac, past a stack of wooden pallets. The man has disappeared. Eric and Yuna exchange a glance, then continue round the corner. Pieces of polystyrene packaging swirl across the wet ground. At the back of the warehouse is a skip surrounded by bindweed and thistles. All the way to the fence are mounds of sand. Their feet leave prints in the wet sand. The man they were following evidently didn't come this way. The steel door by the loading bay must be the entrance to the building. They carry on along the rear of the building, across the sand, feeling the rain drip down their necks. Close to the far corner is another metal door at the bottom of a flight of steps, with metal rails to help move wheelie bins up and down.
"Give me the car keys."
Eric hands them to him, and he removes the metal ring, hands back the little monkey and key, straightens out the metal and makes a hook at the end, pulls a ballpoint pen from his pocket, snaps off the clip and sticks it into the lock, then inserts the straightened key ring, pushes the clip upwards and turns the lock. Chapter 84. The bulb hanging from the ceiling of the waste storage room is broken. The floor is stained from leaking rubbish, and 4 bins reek of rancid food. The tattered remnants of a list of rules and regulations hangs off the wall. In the weak light from outside, Yuna can see another door at the far end of the room.
"Come on,"
he says to Eric. He cautiously opens the door and peers into a small kitchen with a buckled draining board. Rhythmic thuds echo through the walls. The ceiling lamp is on, but there's no one about. On a table, there's a chopping board with a grease-stained paper bag surrounded by crumbs and sugar crystals. There are two closed wooden doors in the far wall. The first is locked, but the second one has no lock. Yuna tries the handle, and they walk slowly into an empty changing room. They can hear music through the walls. The door to the bathroom is closed. They walk cautiously across the concrete floor, past three shower cubicles, a mirrored makeup table, and a row of clothes lockers. Someone flushes the toilet, and they hurry through the room and find themselves in a narrow corridor lined with 10 doors. The small rooms off the corridor have no windows and are furnished with thin beds with shiny plastic mattresses. Behind a closed door, someone is moaning mechanically. The only light comes from strings of fairy lights draped across the ceiling. Little hearts and flowers illuminate the bare walls in weak, flickering colors. The corridor leads to a large storeroom with foil-covered ventilation pipes running across the ceiling. In the flashing lights from a stage, they can make out some 30 men and maybe 10 women. There are sofas and armchairs everywhere. Along one wall is a row of plastic-wrapped pallets full of furniture. It's so dark that it's difficult to discern any faces. The throbbing music keeps repeating one particular musical phrase over and over again. On the stage, a naked woman is dancing round a vertical metal pole. Yuna and Eric walk forward carefully in the weak light. The room smells of damp clothes and wet hair. They keep an eye out for Rocky's bulky frame. He ought to be visible against the light of the stage if he stands up. They know this is a gamble. Rocky may already have been here and left. But if he managed to get hold of any money, he's probably bought some heroin, in which case he could well still be here in the zone. A drunk is trying to negotiate a price with a woman, and one of the guards appears quickly and says something that leaves the man nodding. The music changes, blending seamlessly into a different rhythm. The woman on the stage squats down with her thighs spread wide on either side of the pole. A guard is standing by the bar, gazing out at the room with a motionless face. Yuna sees a black German shepherd moving among the furniture. It looks accustomed to being there as it eats something from the floor, sniffs, and moves on. A large man emerges from the corridor. He blows his nose and heads towards the bar. Yuna moves aside and tries to keep an eye on him. "It's not him," Eric says. They stop by the wall, not far from the stage. It's almost dark, but the reflected glow from the lights rigged up on the ceiling is illuminating an assortment of shirts and faces. Right in front of the stage sits a man in black-rimmed glasses on a red armchair with a label hanging from its arm. On the back of the man's hand is a tattoo of a cross with a shining star at its center. On a low table, 2 bottles are clinking together with the rhythm of the bass. There are very few drugs in sight. Someone is snorting cocaine. A couple more slip pills between their lips, but sex is clearly the main commodity being traded here. A young woman in a black latex bikini and a studded collar comes over to Eric, smiles, and says something he can't make out. She runs a hand through her short blonde hair as she bats her eyelids at him. When he shakes his head, she moves on to the next man. A film is showing on a television screen behind the bar. An aggressive man is walking round a room, hitting doors and pulling drawers open. A woman is shoved into the room, turns and tries to open the door again. The man goes over to her, pulls her backwards by her hair, and hits her face so hard that she falls to the floor.
Just off to one side of Eric and Una stands a man with a coarse face and fleshy forehead. The shoulders of his grey jacket are wet with rain.
Anatoly, I handed my money over when I was searched, he says in a gruff voice.
I know. Welcome, says a voice that sounds adolescent. Una moves sideways and sees that the voice belongs to a tall and very young man with yellowish skin and dark rings under his eyes.
I was thinking of going to the room. Can I buy 2 wraps of brown?
You can buy whatever you like, the young man replies. We've got some top quality from southern Helmand, the usual from Iran, Tramadol, or... Their conversation tails off as they move away between the sofas and people. The dog trots after them and licks the young man's hand. Una falls in behind them and sees them turn off to the right at the side of the stage. Eric manages to stumble into a low lounge table. A beer bottle topples over and rolls onto the floor. He goes a different way, stands on a wet umbrella, and carries on round a leather sofa. The guard by the stage watches him walk. A young woman with round, pockmarked cheeks is sitting astride a man in a leather vest. He twines a lock of her dark hair around his index finger as he talks on his phone. In the darkness, Una can no longer see the young man who was dealing heroin. There are too many people everywhere now. He looks round and sees the black dog slip through a swaying beaded curtain. The beads settle long enough to form the Mona Lisa's face briefly before they part again, and a young woman with bare breasts and a pair of tight leather trousers walks out. Chapter 85. The small beads tinkle as Eric and Una pass through the Mona Lisa. The air is suddenly thick with sweet smoke, sweat, and dirty clothes. All over the coarsely polished cement floor are worn and battered sofas and armchairs. The music from the stage is still audible, but only as the thud of the heavy bass. Semi-naked people are sitting on the sofas or on the floor itself. Most of them look as though they're asleep, while others move lethargically. They're all moving with ghostly slowness, drifting through the realm of the stoned. They walk past a middle-aged woman sitting on a stained sofa with no cushions. She's wearing jeans that are too big for her and a flesh-colored bra. Her face is thin and focused as she holds her lighter under a crumpled piece of tin foil, and then hurriedly inhales the smoke through a small plastic straw. A slender curl of smoke twines up towards the corrugated metal roof. The cement floor is littered with cigarette butts, sweet wrappers, plastic bottles, syringes, condoms, empty packs of pills, and a bundle of fabric samples. Through the smoke, Una can see the man named Anatoly sitting with the new guest on a sofa that's been sliced open, its stuffing hanging out. Una and Eric weave through the furniture. A skinny man in his 70s is sitting on a stained flowery sofa with 2 young women. On the floor behind it, a man lies unconscious in just his underpants and white socks. He looks almost like a child, but his eyes and cheeks are sunken. The syringe is gone, leaving the needle with its little plastic end sticking out of a vein in the back of his hand. On an armchair beside him sits a woman with an apathetic expression on her face. After a while, she bends forward and pulls the needle from his hand, but drops it on the floor. Una sees a guard dragging a man who has thrown up and can't help thinking that this place is the complete opposite of the rich kids' saturnalias. No wishes come true in the zone. Here there are only prisoners and slaves, and the money only flows in one direction. Everyone is alone in their addiction,
drained of all they have until they die. He glances behind him and sees Anatoly stand up and walk through the room. The black dog follows him. A fat man in camouflage trousers and a black jacket pushes away a woman in pink underwear and high heels. She goes back and tries to kiss his hands as she begs him for a fix. The man is impatient, tells her to pull herself together, that she hasn't earned enough.
I can't. They hurt me. They...
Shut up. I don't give a fuck. You need to do 3 more customers, he says.
But, darling, I don't feel good. I need...
She tries to stroke his cheek, but he grabs hold of her hand, pulls her little finger, and bends it sharply backwards. It happens so quickly that at first the woman doesn't seem to realize what's going on. She stares wide-eyed at her broken finger. A man with a salt-and-pepper moustache walks over to them, exchanges a few words with the other man, then pulls the sobbing woman through the room towards the curtain. She stumbles and loses a shoe. Then he hits her, and she falls over, dragging a standard lamp down with her. Yuna and Eric move out of the way. The man drags the woman to her feet, and the lamp rolls away and shines straight into the face of a large, bearded man. It's Rocky Sherklund. He's sitting completely naked in a red armchair, asleep. His head is leaning forward, and his beard looks like it has grown into the hair on his chest. He's injected himself in his right leg, and dark blood is trickling down his ankle. Rocky isn't alone. Beside him, on a sofa bed with no mattress, sits a woman with bleached blonde hair, wearing a brown bra. Her pale blue panties are on the floor next to her. A plaster is hanging half off her knee. She holds a lighter under a sooty spoon and stares with glassy eyes at the small bubbles forming in the water. She licks her lips as she waits for the powder to dissolve, leaving the spoon full of pale yellow liquid. Eric steps over a footstool and walks over to them, smelling the insipid aroma of heroin and hot metal as he comes to a halt. Rocky? Eric says in a low voice. Rocky slowly raises his head. His eyelids are heavy, his pupils like pinpricks of black ink.
Judas Iscariot, he mumbles when he sees Eric.
Yes, Eric says. Rocky smiles happily and slowly closes his eyes. The woman beside him puts a ball of cotton wool in the solution, holds her syringe on top of it, and sucks up the solution, then attaches a needle to the syringe. Yuna notices that the man in camouflage trousers is sitting on a chair outside the staff room again, looking at his phone. At the other end of the room, the man with the grey moustache disappears through the beaded curtain with the woman. "Do you remember telling me about the unclean preacher?" Eric asks, squatting down in front of Rocky. Rocky opens his tired eyes and shakes his head.
"Is that supposed to be me, the preacher?"
"I don't think so. I think you meant someone else," Eric says. "You talked about a man in makeup with scarred veins." Next to them, the woman uses her briefs as a tourniquet round her arm, tightening them as hard as she can by twisting a pen through them a couple of times. "Do you remember him killing a woman here at the zone?"
"No," Rocky grins.
"She was known as Tina, but her real name was Natalia," Eric goes on.
"Yes, that was him. That was the preacher," Rocky mutters.
The woman on the sofa bed looks for a vein in the usual places, a soft spot without too many scars. "I need to know, are we talking about a real preacher, a priest?" Rocky nods and closes his eyes. "Which church?" Eric asks. Rocky whispers to himself and Eric leans forward until he can smell his rancid breath.
The preacher is jealous, just like God, he whispers.
The woman inserts the needle and a drop of blood mixes with the yellow liquid before she injects it. With nimble fingers, she undoes the tourniquet and lets out a long groan as the kick washes through her. Eric watches her stretch her legs, tense her ankles, then relax as her body goes completely soft. We believe the preacher has murdered at least 5 women, and we need a name, a parish, or an address, Eric says.
What are you saying?
Rocky mutters, closing his eyes again.
You were going to tell me about the preacher, Eric persists. I need a name or stop banging on,
the woman says, lying back against Rocky's hairy thigh.
Say hello to Ying,
Rocky murmurs, stroking her head clumsily. While Eric tries to get Rocky to remember, Yuna is keeping an eye on the room. The fat man in the camouflage trousers gets up from the chair outside the staff room and peers out across the room. Yuna watches him put his phone in his pocket and set off through the sofas. He stops by one man who's lying with his eyes closed, a lit cigarette between his lips, then returns to his place.
You want me to tell you things, Rocky says. But all I remember from purgatory is that I was sitting in a little monkey cage, and there were long wooden poles with glowing ends.
Blah, blah, blah,
Ying interrupts with a hoarse laugh.
I howled, tried to get away, tried to protect myself with my food bowl. Blah, blah, blah,
he smiles. Seriously, though, Eric says in a louder voice, I won't disturb you any more if you can just tell me something that will help us find him. It looks as though Rocky's dozed off. His mouth slips open a few millimeters and a string of saliva dribbles into his beard. The man with the gray mustache comes back from the other side of the room. The curtain sways behind him, letting a yellow glow into the room before the Mona Lisa's face reforms.
We can't stay here much longer,
Yuna tells Eric. Ying tries to put her briefs on, but they catch between her toes, and she leans back and rests with her eyes shut.
My brain is mush,
Rocky mumbles.
You need to blah, blah, blah,
Ying says.
Give me a name, Eric persists.
You're probably going to have to hypnotize me if...
Can you stand up? Eric asks. Let me help you. Yuna sees the fact.